This podcast is for healthcare professionals only and is supported by an independent educational grant from Thermo Fisher Scientific.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast where we'll explore best practices in molecular testing and targeted therapy for hormone receptor positive HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer. We'll be discussing the key biomarkers to test for, the timing of tests, and the decision-making process when it comes to treatment. I'm Dr. Rena Callahan, an associate clinical professor of hematology oncology at the University of California, Los Angeles, David Geffen School of Medicine. Today, I'm delighted to be joined on this podcast by pathologist Dr. Roberto Salgado.
Thank you, Rena. So my name is Roberto. I'm a pathologist working in Belgium, and I am co-chairing with Chirin Loy and Carsten Deckner, the consortium of pathologists worldwide called the TILS Working Group. We're working on immune biomarkers, 900 pathologists, 58 countries. So we get a lot of info on biomarkers, and I'm very willing to share all this knowledge with you today. And thank you for inviting me to this podcast.
That's great. It's exciting. And, you know, as we all know, this hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer, it's very common. And so we see a lot in clinical practice of patients that fit this profile. I am a clinical oncologist. I also do clinical research, but see many, many patients. And so this is of the metastatic breast cancer and early breast cancer space. This is by far the largest group. And one of the things that's evolved over the last even just 5 years in terms of how we choose treatments is molecular testing. The role of biomarkers in shaping our treatment decisions has really expanded. It went from something that, you know, we would send this NGS biomarker testing and, more for just curiosity. And now we can actually apply it to clinical practice. And it's very important that we do so because there are several therapies that have been approved for use just over the past few years that are critically important in determining who is eligible for treatment on this biomarker testing. So let's start, Roberto, with some of the most common biomarkers that we use to test for in these metastatic patients.
Exactly. So the two most common biomarkers that are being tested is PI3 kinase alterations. That's one. And the second one is ESR1 alterations in hormone receptor positive disease. And I think I will focus on those two ones because they illustrate a lot of those concepts. Where should you test? In the primary tumor, in the liquid biopsy, or in a metastatic biopsy? And I think it all depends on what biomarker and what line of treatment you are in. There are, of course, additional biomarkers to be explored, AKT, P10, TMB, MSI, etc. Some of them are rather agnostic. MSI, for example, which is mostly given rarely in breast cancer after the third line of treatment. TMB, same, very late, exceptionally, to be honest. There are others, NTRK, for example, conceptually tumor agnostic. And there are others which are more specific, AKT. Now, what is being tested? It depends on your patient, it depends on the line of treatment, and it depends on the type of treatment. And this is something that we're going to discuss of importance today, because you can test one gene, you can test several genes, you can test copy number alterations, or you can test epigenetic alterations. So what do? In daily practice. So we are going to detail all these practicalities. Me, from my pathology perspective, I'm a tissue nerd, and Rena, from her clinical oncology perspective.
Yes, Roberto, absolutely right. This has changed over time. Like I said, this used to be something we would just send the NGS because it could be done, and then we'd look at it, just see whether we found something. But now we have very specific treatments. You had mentioned PI3 kinase and ESR1 being the most important. I would agree with that. You know, we generally use first line for these patients, a hormone blocking therapy with a CDK inhibitor. But then when we move on to the second line of therapy upon progression, we these biomarkers that we look for become much more important because that's how we select treatment. So I tend to send testing at every progression. You know, certain things change over time, such as an ESR1 mutation, which is acquired under selective pressure of an aromatase inhibitor. That's when you'll find it over time. Initially, you know, at the first diagnosis of metastatic disease, maybe you'll find it in 5%. But as you go through multiple disease progressions, you'll find it in up to 40%. And if you find an ESR1 mutation, this makes a patient a candidate for treatment with an oral SERD, a selective estrogen receptor downregulator, such as elacestrant. I usually send, you know, initially a tissue biopsy, and then at each disease progression, I'll send a liquid biopsy with or without a tissue biopsy. And so one of the reasons to do that is just practically, you know, patients in the clinic, disease is progressing, we're drawing blood for other reasons. It's very easy to just draw a few extra tubes for a liquid biopsy. And the turnaround time is very quick. Whereas if you are setting up a tissue biopsy, that can take several weeks. You know, first, you have to arrange for the biopsy, and then you have to get the results back. So that can take some time. There is also a question of yield. You know, sometimes tumors are different. They're heterogeneous, you know, throughout the body. And so potentially you can pick up a greater number of ESR1 mutations with a liquid biopsy. NGS versus PCR, I generally send NGS because you can screen for thousands of genes all at the same time in parallel, whereas with PCR, you have to know more of what you're looking for and be specific. So, you know, that's why I do that at that point and do, you know, look for many genes as the same at the same time. No one's limiting me in that regard. So, you know, I'd love to hear your opinion on the tissue liquid biopsy because, you know, sometimes the circulating tumor DNA, you know, tumor fraction is low, and maybe that affects the yield as well.
Absolutely. And I think you point out several items that we can discuss here. One is, for example, the yield, which is completely true. But the caveat may be, for example, that for some variants, tissue is better than liquid, and for others, it's the other way around. For example, if you take a liquid biopsy, which can be on serum or can be on plasma, and we can discuss the technicalities later on, whether it's a centralized testing or decentralized testing. Basically, what does it mean? It means that the so-called pre-analytical variables are crucial. Why? Because you're looking at tiny fractions of variants, very tiny fractions. For example, in the blood, you also have so-called cell-free DNA, which is DNA coming from everywhere, can come from the leukocytes itself in the blood. So what happens? If you take a blood sample and it takes too long to get to the lab, you start to degrade the immune cells. DNA gets out, the DNA yield gets up, the fraction of tumor yield is diluted. So you might get false negatives, depending if the so-called pre-analytical conditions are not exactly standardized. And I think that's a crucial issue when you work with so-called network hospitals, meaning hospitals organized together in one big network, where you have to send your samples to the central lab in that particular network. Pre-analytics is crucial. What else is something that we basically don't know that much is to what extent freezing or thawing of the blood sample affects the DNA yield. The tumor DNA yield in a liquid biopsy is basically, in general, roughly speaking, 1% of the total DNA in such a blood sample. So anything that affects the total DNA yield affects the sensitivity of your assay. And this is something which is extremely crucial, and one of the main limitations in liquid biopsy is you need to find tiny fractions. And the problem is that there are a variety of different liquid biopsy assays already available. Which one should you use? And there are also very homebrew assays available, which are technically excellent. And you have combined diagnostics and non-combined diagnostics. So you have a variety of things. So what do you do if you have assays with different sensitivities going further? And I'm a pathologist, so maybe let's dive in the technicalities of this. The extraction of DNA. There are different methods to extract DNA, and different methods yield different yields. And different yields of DNA yields different results if you analyze liquid biopsy. Furthermore, combine everything what I said so far. So the uncertainties start to rise when you get the result. And combine this with the notion that you mentioned, which is a very crucial point, is heterogeneity. Breast cancer has around 93 drivers. Should we measure all of them, clinically speaking? Should we measure just one of them? In national healthcare settings where the government only wants to pay for drivers that have level 1A evidence. So from those 93 drivers, you end up with just two of them, P3 kinase and ESR1. So what determines in that particular circumstance, whether it's liquid or whether it's tissue, is the assay and the reimbursement. In many countries, ESR1 testing is done, as you exactly mentioned, during or after treatment, when you see progression, because that's when your rates start to drop. So that's very logical to measure. And liquid biopsy for ACR1 testing is, for example, much better to detect heterogeneity than analyzing the primary tissue. Why? Because it's progressing. P3 kinase, for example, which is already present as a driver in the early days of cancer development, you may actually measure P3 kinase in a much more reliable manner in the primary tumor than the liquid biopsy, because it's already there from the start. It's not acquired during evolution. So I think there are many, many items that determine best practices. And I think the most important from my perspective, and this is something where I put a lot of efforts in my setting, is clinicians need to understand what the pathologist is measuring. What is your assay of your patient measuring? Because there is such a tremendous variability, and clinicians need to understand what exactly is mentioned in the report. And that's a crucial element.
Roberto, I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, it's really interesting to hear how things vary regionally. You know, in the healthcare system that I work in, it is seamless. I have no governor that is saying that I can't perform this testing or that testing. So I just send an NGS, even though I'm at an academic institution, I send a centralized NGS to a platform that I trust that includes, you know, ESR1 and PIK3CA alterations, as well as many, many more for which we might not even have other therapies. Just to add, you know, we test for PI3 kinase mutations, but I think that, you know, we have a therapy, capivasertib, that is approved now in many regions across the world, yep. Right, where we can use that with PI3 kinase mutations, as well as AKT alterations and P10 alterations. So it's very important at least to test for those. And then it allows us to test for those less common those tumor agnostic mutations that you mentioned, like MSI, NTRK, even HER2 mutations, at least in our NCCN guidelines. We can use a small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor called neratinib in combination with trastuzumab and endocrine therapy for patients that don't have HER2 positivity, but HER2 mutations. So when we send this and cast a wide net, we're more likely, I think, to find some of these actionable mutations or alterations. And then to your point about what the pathologist is testing, there is great heterogeneity now in this space that we call HER2 low and HER2 ultra low. So we generally use, you know, our targeted therapies to PI3 kinase, AKTP10, or ESR1 mutations, as the second, as the third line therapy. But at some point, we're considering chemotherapy. And now chemo is largely being replaced by antibody drug conjugates. And the one that is, you know, the most used or broadly used is trastuzumab deruxtecan. And with the recent presentation of DESTINY-Breast06, we see that that therapy works basically across, you know, HER2-positive, HER2-low, and now even HER2-ultra-low. And there's great variation with pathologists and being able to assign HER2-ultra-low, at least, you know, in the U.S., the guidelines, you know, I think it would be very difficult to be a pathologist, especially a community non-breast-focused pathologist, because it's because the guidelines are a bit vague.
Exactly.
What do you think of that?
So this has complicated an enormous amount of things. Even that trial, any HER2 would have been included, we wouldn't have had this debate. That's one. Second, pathologists are able to measure very low quantities of HER2. The difference is we are looking at very subtle differences, very subtle. People don't realize this. So I invite all oncologists, go together with your pathologist, that he shows you, she shows you, what is ultra low. It's practically nothing. And the cutoff is 10% of positive tumor cells. 10%, 10 in 100. And the definition of ultra low means one positive tumor cell in 100 is ultra low. One positive tumor cell in 100,000 tumor cells is also ultra low. And one positive tumor cell in 1 million tumor cells is also ultra low. So that's what we are talking about. The solution is we need to train pathologists. We need to compare each other. We need to find the pitfalls. We need to be aware that this drug exists. And if pathologists are in doubt about the HER2 low or ultra low score, please consult a colleague. And I think these elements, education, awareness, training, and asking a colleague, that combined will mitigate, I believe, a lot of the variability we observe today in the HER2 low, ultra low setting.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I actually think my prediction is that it will be a moot point in a bit, because we have other antibody drug conjugates, say to TROP2. We don't test for TROP2 expression, so it might just go out the window. We'll see, you know, what comes next. So at your center, do you do everything in-house? I mean, you know, having you, especially as a resource with this, who is an expert in this, I'm sure that that affects what your institution chooses to do. Are there times where you send things out?
Well, actually, what we have decided in the region where I work, in Antwerp, in Belgium, 8 years ago, there were potentially 4 molecular pathology labs in one city. So we started to have competition between each other, very human nature. And after a lot of debate and discussions, we decided to have one central lab within the region where we all together communicate and discuss what are we testing. How should we report? How should we educate? And how should we update all clinicians, that every clinician in the region has the same test for his patient without discrepancies? That every clinician in the region and every pathologist in the region is also trained on, this is being tested for your patient, and this is how it should be interpreted. If you find an AKT mutation in breast, it has a different meaning if you find the same mutation in colorectal cancer. And clinicians need to be aware, as pathologists need to be aware, that this difference exists. So what we have done as a model, and we call it Molecular Diagnostic Network Antwerp, it's a fancy name, is we centralize the testing, but we regionally organize all communication surrounding the testing of our patients.
That is a great way to do it, because you're basically, you know, centralizing testing with in your own way by working together, as opposed to, you know, kind of the way that we do it is just sending to an outside lab. But it achieves the same goal, right, which is standardization. So interpretation of results, you mentioned that there is education on how a mutation in one malignancy carries different weight and has different implications than in another malignancy. Do you have a multidisciplinary, molecular tumor board, something like that, at certain intervals where you communicate as with, the pathologist, the medical oncologist, geneticists, et cetera? Do you have that? Or?
Yes. So we have, so every hospital has a molecular tumor board, which is actually what used to be called multidisciplinary boards, which every hospital has to discuss your patients. And we have on top of that one molecular advisory board, a molecular tumor board, whatever you want to call it, which is regional based, where we discuss cases that may be included in clinical trials within the region. For example, we had a case, a lung cancer patient resistant to EGFR inhibitors, acquiring systematic progressive every time a single mutation. Now, patient had a MET alteration, no reimbursed treatment available. That patient should be included in a clinical trial. 8 years ago, where everybody was fighting among each other to attract those patients, now we say, okay, we centralize the information and we send that patient to one single center that has a trial ongoing. Does it work perfectly? No. Is there a long way to go? Yes, of course. Do we have a learning curve to pass? We're still in the middle of that learning curve, of course. But I think it's the right concept. You centralize the testing, you decentralize the communication, and you communicate in a transparent as possible way, in a non-competitive manner, for the best sake of our patients.
Absolutely. To your point, the non-competitive manner is very important, and that's where we get more, information. So do you, at your molecular tumor boards, do individual physicians bring forward cases?
Yeah, and we invite for every particular patient, the clinician that has brought the patient, that knows every single detail of it. Yeah.
Right. Because it's not just about the pathology, right?
No.
There needs to be some sort of clinical background. You can't just say, oh, this patient has a PI3 kinase mutation, they're going to get this therapy, or an ESR1 mutation, they're going to get this. Sometimes they may have both, right? And then how do we decide? We decide based on the patient. And so there's this more holistic approach, the clinical context, whether a patient wants to prioritize quality of life over response rate, perhaps.
Exactly.
Whether there's a goal she's trying to get to, the birth of a grandchild or a graduation or whatever it may be, it's really important to involve the patient and talk about the values of the patient, the goals of the patient, and then bring that to our tumor boards or our multidisciplinary discussions.
Absolutely.
Selecting therapy, right?
So absolutely.
Match the patient with the treatment. That's what we're here to do, is have our patients with metastatic breast cancer live the best life they can live for as long as possible.
Exactly. No, I fully agree.
This has been a great discussion. We're
absolutely
coming to a
enjoyed
close.
It.
And I think we can summarize by saying that the time is now to do molecular testing for hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer, because there are therapies that we didn't have even 5 years ago that we have now, where eligibility is determined by these molecular biomarkers, and that some of them change over time. So it is not enough to test at one point in time. We have to test at several points in time. And then we need to consider the type of testing that we are performing. Are we doing tissue biopsy, liquid biopsy, or both? So
yep.
This is clearly in evolution, and there will
absolutely
clearly be more molecular markers.
And if I can add one single message from my perspective as a pathologist, which is very simple, know your assay. This is so crucial. And I noticed that this is still a very long road that we all need to pass together. Know your destiny. Thank you. Thank you, Rina. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yes, this is very fun. Thanks to our listeners for joining today, and we hope you found this discussion useful.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to find out more, then please look for the Oncology Medical Conversation podcast under the account of Core2Ed Medical Education. Also, don't forget to rate this podcast, subscribe to our channel, and share it with your colleagues. Thank you for listening, and see you next time. This podcast is an initiative of Core2Ed and developed by Precision Oncology Connect, a group of international experts working in the field of precision oncology. The views expressed are the personal opinions of the experts, and they do not necessarily represent the views of the experts' organization or the rest of the Precision Oncology Connect group. For expert disclosures on any conflict of interest, please visit the Core2Ed website.